I'm going to use the blackboard in the beginning, and then I'll show you some data on the computer. Okay, I mean on the PowerPoint. Okay, so thanks for giving me this opportunity to talk here. What I thought of doing was to kind of combine, concatenate these two areas, especially in view of the talk yesterday by Tillman. I can see from the audience there are many people who know a lot about the Fermion-Hubbard model, and I'll be saying things that are very elementary from that point of view. But what I'm hoping is I can distill out of this field a few salient features where, from my limited perspective, some experiments could be done and some dialogue could be generated. So I won't try to be complete, and I won't try to make all the references, etc., but I'll just try to distill out some essential physics. Okay, so let me start by writing the Hamiltonian. So here is the Hamiltonian. It's a lattice model. It could be looked at in any dimension. I will sort of focus more on two dimensions and square lattices, just because one dimension there are lots of exact results that are known. And two dimensions also, I'll keep it simple. I won't look at frustrated lattices and triangles and so on. Just look at the square lattice. And for the purposes of the major part of my talk, I'll even assume that it's a repulsive U. But I will make some statements about attractive U, because yesterday we saw these experiments where they were able to tune U, make it non-interacting, and then go either way. So I'll have some comments on the attractive U as well. And again, part of my motivation is coming from the cuprate story, where the interest was at large U. The parameters for the cuprate put us in a regime of large U, but that's one of the beauties of these cold atom systems, that you're not limited by any material. You can tune the parameters, but at least in the cuprate, U over T was of order 10. But that, of course, is tunable. And the other parameter we can put in is a chemical potential or doping. So let me just define this to be 1 minus number of electrons over number of sites. Okay, so that's the model we would like to study. Now, it's a fermion strongly interacting model. We, of course, don't have any exact results. So what I'm going to do is make some statements at a variational level, and I'll make it a little more precise. Now, here is the model. Let me put down an experimental phase diagram. So this is an experimental phase diagram for cuprate. The missing link that we would like is an experimental phase diagram for the Hubbard model. Okay, so that's kind of where these fields will come together. What we have is this sort of a phase diagram. We have really no idea that it actually comes out of a model like this. We have indications, but that missing link will hopefully be a subject of a lot of discussion. So this is T antiferromagnet as a function of x. This is x equal to 0 with number of electrons equal to number of sites. And that is Tc of x. And you know all this. Basically, this is around, let's say, 100 Kelvin. This temperature is around 400 Kelvin. And there are some numbers here. It doesn't matter. Uh, Okay. So the main features is that there are certain phases that one sees in the cuprate, and of course one would like to see if there's any indication of that in this kind of a model. So now, as I said, we don't, of course, exactly solve it, but I will make some plausibility arguments to show that there are some connections. And then my hope is to actually provide you a picture of what the superconducting wave function along this line looks like, and hopefully that picture might motivate some ways of actually looking at these correlations microscopically. Okay. Now, what I thought might be useful is just to get started, look at a two-site problem. I'm sorry if this will insult a lot of people's intelligence, but I think it's kind of useful and maybe not so so much an artifact in view of Porto's experiments with those two wells. So, and a lot of the energy scales and how the spectrum gets reordered comes out at just the two-site level. So we know with one site, the number of the states we can have are either occupied, unoccupied, up, down, or up, down. And with two sites, you basically have 16 states. And if I impose SZ total equal to zero, then you essentially get four states, which are and with these four states, you can write down the Hamiltonian, H2. So this is all. And it can be simplified even more, but let me not worry about that. And the spectrum is just very simply something like this. This is minus J, zero, U, U plus J. And J is 40 square over U. So very simply from just two sites, you can see a new energy scale that comes out, J, which is 40 square over U. And you see the spectrum break up into a lower Hubbard band and an upper Hubbard band. It's kind of instructive because you can see this new energy scale, and this lowest eigenfunction is just 1 over square root of 2 up down minus down up. It's a singlet state. So obviously the system is favoring the formation of these singlets at low energies. And now you can do the same thing, much more formally, and take that Hamiltonian in TU and project it on the lowest subspace where you have no doubly occupied sites, and look at perturbatively the effects of hopping and show that that Hamiltonian basically gives you the TJ model. This is all fairly well established. And my reason for bringing it up is just that we can now focus on correlations on a Hamiltonian that is appropriate for the low energy subspace. So this Hamiltonian looks like this. Okay, the spin operators are just constructed from the fermion operators. Okay. There should be another. So the P is just a projection operator that says I want to work in a subspace here with no doubly occupied sites. P is an operator. Okay. Right. Now, so far so good. We can do a little more play a little bit with these with this spin physics term, and write it as follows. So it sounds formal, but it has some value to that, which is I'm starting out, as you notice, I'm starting out with a model that is purely repulsive, right? And yet I said I want to describe the superconducting state. So there must be some way of pairing electrons to get a Cooper pair. Right at the repulsive way of looking at it, it's not clear there is any attraction sitting in that model. That attraction is actually getting generated from the formation of these singlets. So already when I look at this term, I have generated a nearest neighbor singlet formation, but you can see it even more explicitly by introducing, let's say, a bond operator. So let me define this operator, which basically creates a singlet bond on IJ. And with that, this J term this can be exactly written with a minus sign, and I think there is a half, not so important. Okay, so basically now you can think of doing just straight mean field theory, give this this bond operator an expectation value and you know, the usual way that one proceeds in BCS theory. But I think this is instructive because it shows how you can go from a positive U-Hubbard model, find the spin correlations in that, and then writing it just in terms of these singlet bond operators, get an attraction, which is then the source of Cooper pairing. You know, if you want, it's also possible to write it in Q space, and then you can show that you get So these are some orbital, these are some pair wave functions in the momentum k, and then you create these pairs with the relative and center of mass momentum. So c k plus q over 2 up. Let me write it for once. Right. And this chi d, this pair gap function, is cos kx minus cos ky. Okay. So, in a nutshell, basically, what one can see is that the gap function is very naturally not S-wave-like with a uniform pairing along the Fermi surface, but naturally has a cos kx minus cos ky D-wave character. And all of this kind of emerges, so that's why there are, you know, there are definitely, there are connections with such a model. Okay, but this, yeah.
I think you should include the N, I, and J terms.
I've been a little sloppy about that. You can include the N, I, and J term. Yeah. Yes. What he's talking about is that there is a 1/4 N, I, and J term as well. Is that what you're saying? Yeah. I've just been a little... I've dropped that term. But, yeah.
How did you obtain the HTJ? Is it equivalent to the first Hamiltonian in the case of two sides? Or only considering the...
It is not... The Hubbard Hamiltonian, if you project it in, this is not exactly equal. There are other parts of the subspace you haven't worried about. But what I'm saying is, if I take this Hamiltonian and I write it out in this analogous way for many sites, you would have a subspace here of configurations where you have no doubly occupied sites. Okay, that would be this chunk here. There'll be huge.
Equivalent to the lower two sides in that case.
It's equivalent to trying to write the effective Hamiltonian in this subspace. So what it is equivalent to is something like it's doing a unitary transformation. So I'm taking H Hubbard. Okay. What I'm doing is I'm taking Hubbard and then I'm doing a unitary transformation which basically eliminates this higher subspace. But I do it by perturbation theory. Like lowest order perturbation theory will get me here and back. So second order perturbation theory takes me, basically you get T square over a denominator which is U, and that's the origin of the J term. But you can formally do it by writing a unitary transformation which will get you a projected Hamiltonian in the lower subspace. I can point you to references. Cohn was the first person to do that, and since we are in Cohn Hall, I guess I should mention that. Okay. So, any more questions? Because now I'm going to move to somewhat some experiments and so on, but at this stage, no? Okay. So now, of course, one could... what I have gotten is a Hamiltonian with a very natural D-wave type order parameter, and I could go ahead and do mean field theory. But we know that we have to do better than that, because the origin of the whole thing is this projection operator. This is kind of the physics of strong correlations. So... hopefully in these cold atom experiments, they will be able to tune you, but at least my motivation coming from the cuprate story was to always think of the strong correlation limit. And what that limit says is that I have to always work in this subspace where there are no doubly occupied sites. And that is showing up as a projection in this kinetic energy operator. So it's fairly easy to ignore that. If I can ignore that projection operator, just look at this Hamiltonian or look at this Hamiltonian and just do mean field theory. But then you would have thrown away a very crucial part of the physics. So what I'm going to show you now is the...
Do you know what's the optimal U over T for experiment to reach the highest...
You mean to get more higher TC? Let me try to answer it this way.
I mean, this phase diagram that you showed is for U divided by T equals
10. Yes. Can I just come in 1 second? I will address two energy levels. And the reason I'm hedging is that one energy scale you'll see goes up with U, but there's another energy scale that comes down with U.
So there is no experimental, I mean, there is no systematic measure.
You mean with, no, that's the whole problem, because you have a bunch of materials, okay? So this is the right. So that was my original caveat, okay? So there are many caveats. You have the experimental system. You don't know the Hubbard model is the true model, but let's forget about that criticism for now. Let's say, you know, I'll make more plausibility arguments as we go along, but let's say the Hubbard model is a good model, in which case it is described by one energy scale, T, U over T, or let's say J. J is the dominant physics. And the problem is we have, what I will show you are results for one set of parameters. Now, if you want another set of parameters to look at cross correlations, there isn't that much, you have to change the material. And then many other things also change. So it's not a nice tunability knob like we have in the cold atoms. But within the theoretical framework, I can give some answer. You know, in the theory, if you move U over T, what do you get? I will give you some answer. Okay. So now the next thing we want to... So let me put it this way, that already even the spin part is very interesting. And that's, I believe, the first thing that people will try in the cold atom experiment is to look for the... just to look for the antiferromagnet. This itself is a very interesting phase, because it is not a, you know, what you might think of a nail state with just up, down, up, down ordering. That ground state has a lot of quantum fluctuations, and it shows up in where in reduction of order parameters. So I won't go into that. But I'll be happy to discuss that later. What I want to do next is to see, given such a Hamiltonian, what kind of wave function psi could we write? Okay. Now, you know, this might seem as a strange approach to people, you know, maybe, I was definitely, when I was talking to Giffrey Vidal, he thought it was very strange. You're given a Hamiltonian, you should be able to take that and chug, 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 get the answer. What is this, you know, assuming some wave function? But, you know, we have to remember that we don't really have exact algorithms for treating fermions. So any approach that gives insight is on the table. And this approach, the variational approach, has been a time-honored approach. BCS wave function itself is a, such a variational guess wave function. The Hall effect, the Laughlin's wave function is also such a guess. So in that spirit, we are going to use a guess. It was motivated by Phil Anderson. So, you know, we can at least, you know, we are in good company. Though he did himself abandon this approach, I must say. He did abandon this approach at one point in time. But anyway, so we are going to...
Not now.
No, now he loves it. But, you know, we have been steadfastly generating more... We started out very skeptical, and because of the evidence that has come out, we are becoming more and more in this, believers of this. But at the same time, the best thing would be to have experiments. We are forming our own tent. Okay, so... Now we are going to draw inspiration from the BCS wave function. So suppose we had to write a BCS wave function, it would look something like this, psi BCS. So let me put down here. Okay. So psi BCS can be written as so basically I'm creating n over 2 pairs in the same state, pi.
K summation should be inside.
I'm sorry. Yeah. And if I, to visualize this, let me write it, let me pick a certain configuration. So let us say I have now what you should picture is something is a lattice, okay, with up and down electrons thrown at some position, whatever. Okay, so I have a lattice, I have n over 2 electrons and n over 2 up electrons and n over 2 down ones. The number, they could be different from the number of sites. Okay, and that's the number of holes I have. So given this configuration, I know if I had a BCS weight function, I know what the weight would be. I know this weight. And that would be just this state projected onto this configuration, and it would look like this. It would just be a Slater determinant of all these pairs phi, where phi of R is nothing but the Fourier transform of phi of K. Let me use phi of rho. And phi of k is equal to the usual vk over uk. Okay? And this is like I'm doing just BCS theory, but you'll see very quickly that there is some very important physics which will make the results completely different from BCS theory. All I've done is I've said that I have n up and n down, n over 2 up and n over 2 down electrons, and if I took a particular configuration, the weight, the amplitude of that would be given by this determinant. This is just the determinant of R I up minus R prime J down. Okay? That's the determinant. And what goes into constructing these pair wave functions? It's just, you know, given by this BCS form, VK over UK, and that contains essentially two variational parameters. It contains the delta naught. If we were doing BCS theory, this would just have been the gap, but let's treat it as a variational parameter, and you know, another one which is mu variational, which I won't worry about. But let's just say it has this one parameter. Now, this would have been okay if we were doing BCS theory, but as I said, we have strong correlations. So the way we put that in is by saying that typically I am allowed any configuration, but my Hamiltonian only wants to work in a subspace where double occupancy is suppressed. So that means so let me just illustrate it with four sites. Okay, so suppose I had two up and two down electrons. Of course, the amplitude for pairing up and down on the same site because of the phi function is zero. It's a D-wave state. But I could still form something like this. This and this could be paired, and this other one could be paired. Okay, so this is an allowed configuration if I didn't want to suppress double occupancy. But since I want to work in the low energy Hilbert space where the projection requires only single site occupancy, I will not allow this. Instead, the kinds of states I will allow are of this kind. Given a configuration like this, I can get this kind of pairing, or I can get something like this. Okay? So the whole question now is that if out of your possible configurations you throw out some of the configurations, which are becoming more and more rare as U becomes large, what is the consequence of that? So it's a very sharply defined question. We know when the projection is zero, what we get just BCS predictions or BCS results. Now we want to turn on this projection and see what comes out. So let me turn to this and show you some results.
By the way, can I ask what is the connection of this ansatz to the Leggett and Nozier-Smith thing? It looks
They have not put in this crucial physics of the projection. Okay, what they have done is in the BCS-DC crossover, they propose a wave function like this. For any value of the coupling, it's just the function phi changes. Okay, now what is the trial wave function that I will use will be something like this. Let me just do it here. So what I'm going to propose is that for understanding that superconducting state at varying doping, a wave function that is a good guess is something like this. So you take the BCS wave function, which you can visualize as this Slater determinant projected for various configurations, but you limit the configurations that are allowed in this. That's the only change you make. So, you know, you're going to see, well, what comes out of such an experiment, a numerical experiment.
What are you trying to understand?
Okay, that's right. I mean, we are trying to understand that phase diagram. Okay, the first question we want to understand is this feature. The first question we want to understand, I sort of drew this as the antiferromagnetic scale. The high TC cube rates seem to have this phenomenon, this feature. So I'm going to not worry about the antiferromagnetic phase. I'm going to focus here. And the I'm writing ground states. I will measure energy scales, and I will make comments about temperature dependence of some of these things. Okay, but let me say what is the part we want to address. We want to address this one single important feature that comes out in the cube rate that you see a TC which has a certain doping dependence, but another energy scale, T star, which does not seem to follow TC. Okay, what is the reason for these two energy scales? What is a microscopic picture is what will come out of these calculations. Okay, that's one focus. And what I would like to kind of say is that even though we are not able to solve the Hubbard model exactly, this wave function gives us fairly low energy to be competitive states for the ground state. So we do believe these are features of the Hubbard model. And hopefully in the experiments they would see these two energy scales. Okay, now at the, yeah.
Maybe it's a little early and you will comment about it later, but does this approach in the end give something different from Slade-Bosonmean field theory, for example? Are there new results that are completely different than...
Yeah, there are. I may not go into that in so much detail, though, in today's talk. But let me address it in the following way. Ehud's question has to do with, okay, it looks like a very simple ansatz, right? I have a wave function, I've put a projection. And you might say, well, now I have a wave function, why don't I just calculate whatever I want in this wave function? It turns out even that step is not easy, even after you have proposed a guess wave function. This is a many-body wave function that depends on many coordinates. Once you have put the projection, it is a horrendous task to try to do that analytically. So there has been another approximate method called slave bosons or other Gutzwiller approximations, etc., etc. These are all various stepping stones to applying that projection in an approximate way. And what we have done is used Monte Carlo methods to apply that projection exactly. Okay, so I won't really say that much about the Monte Carlo method, except to say that it's having chosen the wave function, so having made an assumption about the wave function, after that the results are exact, numerically exact, let's be even more precise. So numerically exact, which means we have control of the error bars. Of course, your initial guess could have been completely off the, completely off the wall, in which case we have nothing to say. But we do believe these wave functions, we can compare with other wave functions, check the energy. They are pretty good in energy, but that's not the whole story. We do believe they also can get the correct correlations. And the difference with slave boson is that it puts the projection physics exactly thereafter.
Sure, yeah, but from the results, point of view of the results, is there...
There are some very... There are qualitative differences for some of the excitation spectrum, which I may or may not come to. But if I do, I will point it out. In other words, some of the spectrum is... The doping dependence is very different. But at some level, qualitatively, it contains the physics of what projection is doing. So I like that approximation. Okay, so here is the...
It's
zero temperature right now, and it's an energy scale, or it's a delta. It's one of these variables. So what I'm plotting here. Now.
You're plotting the variational delta?
Yeah. I just need a... Okay, what I'm plotting is this. So remember my wave function, just one more time, I want to show you the wave function so we are all on the same page. I have the Hamiltonian, it's a TJ type of Hamiltonian. My wave function has this, for any given configuration, it has this Slater determinant and a projection, which basically says I must only look at singly occupied sites. Okay, when I expand this wave function, I get lots of these pictures of pairing. So when I expand that determinant, I get a sort of a soup of these singlet pairs. This is one snapshot. I can pair them up in many ways, and that is why it has been also called the resonating valence bond liquid as a description of these states. So now what I'm going to do is, my procedure is the following. I have a wave function. I have a Hamiltonian. I can calculate the energy as a function of my single variational parameter delta naught, which was the pairing scale, delta naught. And then I can look. Yes. So inside phi, if you remember, inside phi of k, I have a delta k sitting, which is delta naught cos kx minus cos ky. So this delta naught is a variational parameter, and at each value of x, I find out what is the optimal delta naught. Yeah, I didn't want to enter that. So we are actually doing it in the canonical ensemble. So I fix a certain number of up and down. Okay, there is another variational mu, but let me not enter that. Okay, so this is what comes out, that this variational delta at each value of doping has some dependence. And you can see this was when n up was equal to n down, and you still see that there is a signature of pairing at that point. And that pairing scale comes down with increasing x. Okay? Yeah.
What is the relationship between that variational delta and the actual delta in the real trial wave function? Because, I mean, the projection is not clear that...
Yeah, so what I have done is just put in a delta naught. So let me fix x. Fix the doping or fix the chemical potential. Okay? And I find the energy as a function of delta. Okay? And I find the optimal delta naught for that x. And now I'm plotting that delta naught.
I guess the question is, what's the relation between the quasi-particle?
Yes.
The actual quasi-particle energy
and that, yes. So I'm coming to that. So you can answer that question. So here, of course, I've just put some, it's a variational parameter. You can also do, this is something we have done, you can also ask, suppose I wanted to look at a gap. How would I do it? I would remove one of the electrons from my, one of the fermions, I would remove that, put it in a plane wave state, and I would then project that. That would give me the true energy of the gap with the projected state. Right? What I'm saying is, I can create a quasi-particle in the BCS state, in the usual way. And then I can project that, look at that energy, and that energy falls exactly on this delta. So this delta has the interpretation now of being a gap to the excitation spectrum, single particle gap to excitation.
But it tracks delta naught?
Yes, it tracks delta naught. Okay, so that's one thing you can calculate. The other thing you can calculate given this wave function is what Tillman was showing us yesterday, the off-diagonal correlations. He showed it to us in a bosonic field, phi dagger 0, phi r, but you can also look at that in the fermionic field, c dagger, c dagger, c, c, at two distant points, and from that you can get the order parameter, and the order parameter does something like this. Okay, so this is very unusual. You would never see that in a BCS state, that the order parameter and the pairing gap are different. These would be identical in the BCS state. And the reason for this difference is just coming from the strong U physics. Because you can see when you go to small x, you know, with very few holes, you can still have pairing of these singlet bonds. You know, remember the picture of the wave function. You have these soup of singlet bonds. You can still have those singlet bonds, but this quantity is trying to track the coherence. You're taking two electrons, destroying it here, and trying to put it somewhere else. And you can only put it somewhere else if you have holes there, and the probability of that goes like x squared. And as a result, phi, which is the square root of that, goes like x at small x. So there's no way that the coherence scale and the pairing scale could have gone together in a strongly correlated system. So, okay, that's the first message.
Is there a simple explanation why there is some doping which a simple tensor?
Yes. So you are at large doping, okay? At large doping, basically you have a lot of holes. And that's becoming more like the BCS limit. You can see the two things are starting to go together. And one, the effective J, which is the coupling, becomes weaker because your bonds, you know, there are so many holes that you have to form a singlet bond with a very far off electron, and the effective bond strength is dropping. And that's the cause of the pairing getting suppressed.
So this is the BCS.
This is the BCS limit at large doping. So that's another nice thing that you can recover both limits in this wave function.
But the delta S and the unit of energy and phi is...
I'm sorry?
The unit of delta is...
Yes. So right now it's just it's delta over T, but I can put some energy... I can put a scale on it by fitting with experiments. I have to fit one point.
My question is, phi is dimensionless, right?
Yes, phi is dimensionless.
When you say that they have phi, for like what
reason? Sorry, ask your question again.
So you said that in the large question you work at recovery of the BCS.
So delta is in units of hopping. P is dimensionless, but you can, the long distance limit of C dagger, okay, there's some energy scale, but then it would be basically delta square in the BCS limit, right?
In units of T.
In units of T.
I understand. What's the question? What was the question?
So the question is, what's the energy scale associated with T?
P is just an order parameter, so it is. It's basically your energy. So if you were doing BCS theory, you would get delta, which is an energy scale divided by, let's say, U or whatever your attraction was in your Hamiltonian. Yeah. So what is setting the scale for this case? What is setting the scale? So let me just...
The small doping is delta times x.
Yes.
And essentially then it reaches delta...
It reaches delta at this scale. And what is setting the scale for delta is really J. J sets the scale for delta.
Yeah. Let me just ask about the antiferromagnetic limit. Since Edison, he himself is the one who pointed out that if you have that wave function, this wave function, but change the range, I mean, depend on the range of the this wave function, you get an antiferromagnet. But somehow this does not. Right? So is it because of a particular form, the BCS form, or this UK or BK, but if you take a more general form, can you recover an antiferromagnet?
So let me just paraphrase Jason's question, because it's an important question, and I know Thierry also has thought a lot about that issue. The point is, at x equal to 0, what I get is an insulating phase, but it's not antiferromagnetic. So it's not able to reproduce all the pieces there. You can do that in two ways. One is by using more generalized wave functions, which allow for both kinds of ordering. But another way that that Jason is pointing out is, you see, the form of phi is completely, at some level, arbitrary. I could play around with many forms of phi. I have tried to use the intuition from BCS to build its structure, but I could be more general. And Liang, Dusso, and Anderson showed many years ago that at x equal to 0 for the antiferromagnetic case, if they used certain phi of r with long-range spin singlets, where the range, the phi of r went like 1 over r to some power, then they could recover long-range order.
They use the spin form. And
right.
As I know, nobody has been able to reproduce their function in fermion.
Right, exactly. So that's what I said. At x equal to 0, for just the pure spin problem, they were able to do that. And one, this is a good, this is sort of open. Could one get more generalized forms to recover both phases?
What's the problem? If I had to design a BCS wave function such that at half it has that particular
right.
Range.
So let me put it this way. Right now, actually, we are trying to do that with a more generalized wave function. What is the problem? The problem is, some of us are nervous about minimizing too many parameters. So we have right now worked with sort of two. And now you automatically add like 3 and 4 and 5, depending on whether you keep various shifts. So, yeah, go on.
Comment on the fact that there were actually several works that took these BCS wave functions face value and just added antiferromagnetic by hand. And then you see that the variational energy goes down. But this is not the same.
I think
For example, with PRP, we had a function which was a little bit the same than this one, except instead of pairing the free fermions, you pair the anti-ferromagnetic excitations. Then you have both anti-ferromagnetism at half filling and the superconductivity when you start doping. And it's sort of very small number, just that one variational parameter.
Right.
And what is quite interesting is to see that if you do it for the Hubbard model, then this wave function still gives you the superconductivity, while in that model there is absolutely no reason to have a delta which is non-zero at half filling. So here you could say that the reason why you get the phi is because you already got the delta which is non-zero at half filling, which has nothing to do with superconductivity, and then, variational parameters cannot vary discontinuously. So when you dope, you will get this delta which goes down, and then it gives you superconductivity. But if you use this anti-ferromagnetism plus superconducting wave function for the Hubbard model, then you see that both the phi and the delta want to go to zero at half filling, but do grow when you go away from half filling. So that, in my mind, is at least some indication that maybe the physics which is there is not completely an artifact of the variational wave function.
That also is a variational wave. Yeah, we are actually looking at your story more carefully, and we should talk about it, but there are some discrepancies there. Okay.
So is it correct that you associate E times T as a TC?
Delta times? Sorry.
The order parameter times T as TC.
Actually, we have also done, not quite, but we are also, a better way to do in terms of getting the energy scale is to get the superfluid stiffness, because that's directly an energy scale.
Actually, on that respect, is it possible to measure, for example, what is the current carried by a single quasiparticle, for example?
Yeah. We have those results, but I may not talk about it here. But we can talk about it, because what I was trying to do was to give kind of a high TC 101 type thing, so we can talk a little more about the cold atom story. So that these are all very, very important questions, and for the cuprates also important, because they're able to measure some of these, but it's not clear here. So what I would say is the single, what would be interesting is to say get at something like this. Where is that? Something like this. So here is, we talked about pairing, and we also know about these RF spectroscopy measurements, where they are able to, make excitations into a higher level. You have the 1 and the 2 level, and you can make excitations into a higher level. And if these fermions are paired, there is a shift in the energy. And from that, people can measure the gap. Now, so that itself would be important to measure to get some story of along these lines, as a function of doping or as a function of U, what is the energy gap and what is its variation? And then what the high TC story brings out is that there are a lot of K dependencies which are interesting. Now, if that also can be monitored, then, for example, the delta, the gap, has a very strong variation in momentum space. So let me make that clear, what I'm talking about. Eraser. So here is my two-dimensional system. And let's say it has some Fermi surface. The exact form of the Fermi surface is not really important. It has some form. And around, on the Fermi surface, a D wave gap opens up. And the D wave has some variation like this. So it goes to zero at some point called the nodal point, and it reaches a maximum away from that. So this is now experimental data. In our theory, of course, we have assumed a D-wave gap, but there were earlier calculations by Gross and other people where they checked all these energetics. So I'm not going into that. Now, this is the kind of this is experimental data from angle-resolved photoemission spectroscopy. And something like that could be done in the cold atoms as well. You know, essentially in these experiments, you send a photon and you eject an electron. But there could be other ways of just ejecting fermions where you can, you know, go and tweak, just like this RF spectroscopy measurements, as a function of K, if one were to extract the fermions and then try to deduce what kind of an environment it came from, then the gap around the Fermi surface has this form which is fit very well by a D-wave spectrum. Okay.
You weren't going to talk about it, but I just want to understand what the statement is. So it has been shown that within these kind of variational wave functions, there's a D-wave is preferred?
Yes, yes. That was work by Gross and collaborators. They looked at where you have to still try out within a class. So it's not like you have made a statement. So within certain classes of wave functions, you can try different kinds of pairing symmetries, and they did find that D wave is the lowest in energy. Okay. Now coming to Ehud's question, okay, what more can one say? So we have some picture of the pseudo gap. Of this regime in temperature where you are getting pairing, but coherence is getting set up at a much lower energy scale. And the question is, can we say more about these regimes? Okay, actually, before that, I want to say something about the superconducting state itself. We saw some very nice measurements of the momentum distribution yesterday where, in fact, they were able to tune to the non-interacting limit and get, you know, our well-understood Fermi surface and then increase the interactions and see how the Fermi surface changes. So one can ask in a similar situation here, what does the Fermi surface look like? And what you find is that the Fermi surface looks sort of like this. These are all occupied states. And then it's unoccupied outside. Now, when a gap opens up, so typically if you have N of K which is doing like this, and a gap opens up, it sort of broadens the Fermi surface on a scale of delta. This is N of K. But you know that in this D wave case, there are certain directions where delta vanishes. So along those directions, your N of K must still have a sharp jump. And we can calculate that. It shows one or two important things. So this is N of K as a function of K going along this direction, along the node. And you see, first of all, there's a sharp jump, which tells you that there must be well-defined quasi-particles in the system. Okay, by that, all I mean is that you have these electrons, and they are not completely decohered by lots of multi-particle excitations, but there is some weight in a very well-defined quasi-particle. So that's the weight here. But also you see that N at K equal to zero has gotten considerably reduced. Usually, the Fermi surface just reconstructs on a small perturbation around the Fermi surface. N of K would just reconstruct because of pairing on a small scale. But this is coming from the strong U physics, which has pushed states. The projection is a very localized projection which upsets states over many, all the way down to k equal to zero. So even these states have been pushed out. So that would be another way of monitoring the effect of strong interactions, just monitoring what happens at n k equal to zero. And then here is what you can follow, how this jump changes with X, and you see that Z basically gets driven all the way down to zero when you reach this Mott insulator. So X equal to zero is an insulator, which I'm calling a Mott insulator because it is driven by strong correlations. And what you are seeing here, what comes out of our calculation is that this Mott insulator is described by a large Fermi surface. So if you try to measure N of K, it would kind of be counting all the electrons, and you would see sort of a fuzzy N of K counting a big Fermi surface. But if you tried to look at the quasi-particle weight there, the sharpness of that, that weight will go to zero as you go toward x equal to zero. So the quasi-particles are not, most of the weight is becoming incoherent.
But these wave functions, we can't produce a phase where a finite doping, this phi vanishes with finite doping.
Z vanishes? Sorry, what? Vanishes at finite doping. That's not really true. For this Hamiltonian, we find that phi vanishes only at x equal to zero. But that's a very important question about the nature of other states. And you can get phi vanishing even at finite x for
your
some
variational wave function.
Yes, but not for this Hamiltonian. For other ones.
Well, what do you mean, your Hamiltonian or your variational wave function?
So I think what you asked is, could the order parameter actually vanish at a finite x?
Like you have finite number of poles.
Yes.
But
right.
You have
right. So basically, for this Hamiltonian, we don't find it happening. But we have recently put a paper on the web, and I don't want to go down that route right now, where it's a slightly different Hamiltonian called the Southern and Shastri model with some more diagonal bonds. The same kind of wave function for that model is actually giving us a very unusual state. Let me come back to that. That's another story. But for this one, we don't find that. But to answer your question in short, this wave function has the possibility for producing a state with no order parameter at finite x. Okay, let me put the statement that way. Okay. Now, I'm going to skip some more things on the excitations. You know, we can talk about that. But we have... maybe I'll just mention this because this was a prediction that came out of these calculations, so it may be interesting. This is a calculation we did. We have these nodal points where you can make excitations, and you might ask, what is the velocity of these excitations? And we were able to calculate that from these wave functions. So this is actually a pretty non-trivial calculation because we are able to say something about excitations. So in that process, actually, we have made a lot of technical developments at the variational level that can be used for a host of other problems, even the electron gas. You know, what is the effective mass of a 2D electron gas? This is a fundamental question. And people haven't been able to get to that, even though we have good wave functions for the ground state, because we don't know how to describe the excitations. We have formulated a way of getting excited state information from using some rules, okay, which I won't go into, but I just show you the evidence that we can calculate the velocity of the quasi-particles at the nodal point as a function of x, and you find that this is independent of x. And if you look at some of these slave boson things, you get a fairly strong x dependence. Okay, and this is numerical data, that these error bars are numerical error bars. You can compare it with some experiments done a few years later from Stanford, and they were able to measure energy versus momentum of these quasi-particles, and they found, this is for many different doping, you can see this, they are independent of X. And even the number agrees very well. So here is our theory giving some number of... around 2 in electron volt angstrom, which is a funny unit, but that's what they use. And this is the experiment. So this, you know, we can make some... This is in the superconducting state. At the nodal point, you can make excitations which are low energy. Okay?
How do they have an experiment below point... It looks like, what's the doping? Oh, it's
still in the superconducting phase. One has to treat these things with a big lump of salt. You know, they really don't know what the dopings are. But at least the message is that for a host of dopings, it's temperature independent. It's doping independent. So, okay.
These variational ground state wave functions, you generalize to
No, we don't generalize. We use just the wave function. You know, the beauty of the wave function is you can calculate any zero, any equilibrium correlation function, right? No matter how complex. So now what you can do is you can write some rules over there. So the key quantity is the spectral function. So this is the spectral function, which is the probability of extracting an electron at some momentum k and energy omega. In fact, this would be a, you know, I would like to have some discussions on whether such a quantity could be extracted by one of these, you know, spectroscopic measurements. And basically, we know that in some rules of on this quantity, okay, d omega, this sort of a integral, this sort of a sum, this sort of a integral moment of the spectral function can basically be related to various commutators, higher and higher order commutators. And these commutators are complicated operators, but you can evaluate it in the ground state. And from that, you can say something about the excitation. So that's the general idea. Okay, now let me try to quickly end by saying just a little bit about the pseudo-gap phase. You know, we have sort of discussed it very generally by saying it has pairing and coherence at different temperature scales, but is there something, could we characterize it better? So there is a lot. There are a lot of different experiments people have done to probe it, and I'll mention a few and then also connect with some simulations we have done in this regime. So for example, spin susceptibility. What you do is you apply a magnetic field and try to see what is the response of the system, and that gives the spin susceptibility chi as a function of temperature. Now these are real experiments done by Takigawa and Alul on the cuprates. And they basically found that the system looks very different from both a Fermi liquid, which would have given a susceptibility that is temperature independent at low temperatures, and also a BCS superconductor would have given a susceptibility that drops like this, but only at TC. So you would have seen a constant, and TC is around 80 Kelvin or so, somewhere here. At that point, it would have dropped. But these cuprates start dropping at a much, much higher temperature. Okay, so again, this would be one signature of spin pairing, which is making the susceptibility drop. So now we have some, these are much older simulations, but I think they are becoming relevant in view of the fermion model we heard about yesterday, where the pairing was attractive. Now, you know, I've been talking about the positive U-Hubbard model. We don't have similar calculations for that at finite temperatures, and that would be one thing to push for finite temperatures. But we can draw some lessons from the attractive U-Hubbard model, because ultimately, even the positive U, as I showed you, generated attraction in a D-wave channel. So if you forget about the D-wave channel part of it, what is the consequence of just having attraction? That is something one can start investigating in an attractive U-Hubbard model, which has some technical aspects that make it easy to work with, even though it's a fermion model. Okay? So here is a fermion model, but you can work with it at finite temperatures and so on. Okay, and this is what you find, that there is... Okay, let me skip this. You can calculate the spin susceptibility. This is now Monte Carlo calculations at finite temperature. These are different from the variational ones I was talking about, because there we assumed a wave function. These are practically exact for the attractive model, even though it's a fermion problem. Okay? And what you see are some of these features. The spin susceptibility is dropping like a, you know, dropping really fast, but at a temperature which is much higher than TC. TC is somewhere here. And you can already see the susceptibility dropping. And that's the signature of pairing.
N equals a half here. Is that half an electron per site? Or
that's like quarter filling.
It's quarter filling.
Yeah. So about, yeah, half an electron per site.
Have a sign for them?
No. if for this model you can show if you have equal numbers of up and down fermions, you don't get a sign problem because there are certain cancellations which exactly give you a positive number. Okay, and so I think, you know, we saw some signatures of that in the data yesterday when the attraction was made strong. You know, there were these oscillations that one was getting at weak attraction suddenly freezing up at strong attraction, and one could look at some of these features more in more detail. For example, another very nice experiment to probe the excitations is in NMR, what is done is you take a spin and you flip it, and then you let the spin relax, and it does that by dumping energy in whatever excitations are available. And that NMR relaxation rate is also very strongly temperature dependent. So all of these things are pointing to the fact that you have some pairing in the pseudo-gap scale, and these are just different ways of probing that. There are connections you can make between the susceptibility and 1 over T1T, and I'm running a little bit out of time, but let me say that some of these connections are very different from what you get in Fermi liquids. So Fermi liquids would basically find 1 over T1T going like susceptibility square, and what they see in the experiments is that this goes like the linear power of the susceptibility. And again, these are a little more detailed, but nevertheless, they point to non-Fermi liquid behavior once you start getting pairing. And that's kind of another focus of doing some of these attraction experiments, is to look for signals when you don't get Fermi liquid behavior. So the attractive U-Hubbard model, again, is able to reproduce some of these features. Yeah. And let me bring up another interesting quantity. While the spin susceptibility is dropping with temperature starting at T star, you can look at the compressibility, which is a response of the density of the system. And typically in a Fermi liquid, the spin susceptibility and the compressibility are exactly the same and temperature independent. But you can see in the case of pairing, so whether it's attractive or it's repulsive, in both models, I would say, you would see this difference between the density fluctuations as a function of temperature and just the spin fluctuations doing very different things. So again, basically a characteristic of pseudo-gap physics. Okay, similarly, entropy loss and so on. I don't know, how much time should I just try to... Can I take like 5 more minutes at this point? Okay. So a very direct probe of the pseudo-gap is tunneling. And this was also seen... of course, there are much finer experiments now, but even the very early ones... So you're basically trying to tunnel into a superconductor, and if there's a gap, then you see a loss of weight. And again, what one saw was that there was this gap kind of feature at high temperatures above TC. And we can also look at such things in the simulation. This is now plotting the value of the density of states at zero energy. Okay? So again, what you see is, here is the density of states at zero energy as a function of temperature. TC is somewhere here, but you start seeing a loss in weight starting at a much higher temperature. And that correlates with the spin susceptibility. Okay. Now, all of these things would be kind of obvious if we were in a very BEC regime, where you had tightly bound, you know, bosons and so on. But N of K shows, so this is N of K for one of these data that I showed you. N of K is only slightly broadened. Here is the broadening due to temperature, and it's only slightly broadened. So it's still very degenerate, very fermionic system, but you are still seeing properties of strong, you know, pairing. So in other words, what I'm trying to say is that you get like properties of both fermionic and pairing physics in some of these intermediate regimes, and they can be tracked by different quantities. Okay, so let me turn to one very new phase that has been brought into focus by recent ARPES experiments, and that is what has been called the nodal metal. So, and this this also goes back to some of the data by Shank et al. In a recent experiment where they have unequal populations of fermions. Okay, and what all of these experiments point to, we have been talking about a pseudo-gap phase at finite temperatures, where you have pairing which occurs at a higher temperature and coherence at a lower temperature. The question is, this is an unusual phase at finite temperatures, but what would be the fate of such a phase as you came down lower in temperature? You know, what would be, what happens to that phase? So let me take you through this very carefully, because this is definitely a new prediction that is coming from ARPES. So here is the point, that I've drawn this Fermi surface. There is a gap that opens up at the Fermi surface, and that gap has a point node and then finite gap everywhere. So that's shown here. Now, as one goes up in temperature, so let me just sit at two values of x, here and here. So this is, let's say, x2, x1. Okay, so as I fix my doping, I'm coming down, I'm starting here. All along in this superconducting phase, the gap, the Fermi surface looks like one point node, and everywhere else it is gapped. As you go up in temperature in this region here, the pseudo-gap region, a certain arc around the Fermi, around this point, nodal point, becomes gapless. And this region just increases with temperature. Finally, you get a completely gapless Fermi surface. Okay, that's the progression along some line like this. Now, if you sit at a much more underdoped system, which has no superconductivity, what these people found, and so this is just a picture of that same thing, that you have a gap delta as a function of phi, which basically goes to zero here, and at higher temperatures, you get a region around the Fermi surface which is gapless. Now, let's make this plot, which is that arc length. So let me define this to be the arc length, which is the region around the Fermi surface where you have gapless excitations, and let us go down in temperature. So they are looking at a sample like x1, and they are coming down in temperature, plotting that arc length, and they find that it goes all the way like this to a point node at t equal to zero.
Well, I think they don't have a data point where there is no superconductivity.
My understanding was that this system was all in the pseudo-gap phase.
Yeah, but in doping, it's not so important, but in dopings where there is superconductivity, it always jumps to zero, to just a node below TC. But,
yeah.
But then when you try to extrapolate what happens to at zero temperature, if this phase persisted, then you find that it extrapolates to zero.
No, so let me say what I understood. This was the length of the arc.
Yeah, that's completely
it,
true.
It either does this. It does this for x equal to x2. The arc length goes to zero at some temperature TC.
No, so that's not what they see. No, it jumps to zero at temperature TC. It basically jumps to zero, but if you extrapolate the to zero temperature. So it's linear, the length of the arc is linear with temperature, and if you extrapolate to zero temperature, you get a nodal point. But on the way, you're interrupted by superconductivity, where it essentially jumps completely continuous. Actually, I got data from them on how it jumps to zero. It jumps very, very fast to zero. But if you disregard this jump, you try to extrapolate it, seems to extrapolate to a node.
So you're saying that at the last point, let's say about point
there is
one
a jump.
Over there, it just jump over that jump.
Exactly.
I guess the interesting thing would be if, so what would be interesting from such experiments? This is like the very first one, but basically what would be interesting is to ask whether in the state at zero temperature, can you get a non-superconducting state that just has point nodes or something? See, basically, you have a theorem called Luttinger's theorem, which says if you don't have a broken symmetry, then the Fermi surface must enclose all the electrons. Okay? So now if you got a phase like this, which was non-superconducting, it would break Luttinger's theorem with a vengeance because you just have four point nodes. Okay, now whether this really is existing and some other order parameter is not kicking in, we don't know. But all I'm saying is these different experiments, this one, Shank's experiment on the unequal fermions, are all pointing to at least maybe Ketterly. This is from Ketterly's group where they see, of course, there are many issues. So the temperature is pretty high and all these issues are there, but they still claim they have a phase where you don't have, at a fairly low temperature, they claim, where you don't have superfluidity as measured by the condensate fraction or vortices, but you do have some pairing as measured by RF spectroscopy. So,
well, I think in their case, that the Luttinger theorem, I don't think it will be violated because this nodal phase, normal phase is there, it's very dramatic because there's a huge change. But let's go back to Hood's comment. So if it's interrupted by the superconducting phase, then it wouldn't be a violation.
No, because then it's okay. But the point is that, we don't know that gray region, things could happen there.
I'm just confused. When you start talking about spectrum as a function of temperature, it's confusing. So is it because there's still, you're at low temperatures compared to that dotted line, and so you don't have to worry about...
Are you talking about...
I just understand...
This one?
Yeah, so the variation of the spectrum. So once you're at finite temperature, then you're...
Even at finite temperatures, you can look. No, I can make an experimental statement. You can measure the spectral function A of K and omega as a function of temperature, and you can see how the spectrum changes with temperature. Right?
I thought these are experiments. Right? These are theory.
These are experiments. Sorry, are you talking about theory? So let me say, in the experiment, you can very sharply...
separation between those scales. Like you can talk about temperature variation of the spectrum without worrying about that what you're really measuring is some trace over excited states as well, because you're finding temperature.
Sure.
In other words, the gap, the pseudo gap, let's say, is where that dotted line is still large compared to the temperature that you're at.
Yes. So take a look at something like this. What the Fermi surface looks like, you get gapless here, but you get a gap scale. So your delta naught is temperature dependent. There's some temperature dependence to that, but you are also getting gapless excitations here. And you can define these. Of course,
I don't know if you can define precisely.
Yeah, you can
define.
You can always write down a way of, you can always write down the Green's function. After all, what is being measured is a spectral function. And you can always define it at finite temperatures. There's no problem with that.
But, you know, you have a well-defined experimental definition. Because at finite temperature, you always have the spectral weight even at zero energy, even away from this arc. Right. But their ad hoc experimental definition is whether there is a peak at zero energy or a peak away from zero energy. That's
right.
Their experimental definition of the arc. So if at some point in k-space, the peak moves away from zero energy, and that's where they call it.
But there's always
some weight.
Right. I mean, if I show you the pictures, it's you have to look at it with some trained eye, because the shifts are very tiny. You know, we are talking about a method which was used for chemistry. You know, ARPES was used for deep scattering from deep states. Now here we are talking about the gap scale is about 40 millivolts. So you're talking about tiny shifts to get the whole shape. And there is always a lot of, these are details of the experiments. You know, there are lots of backgrounds and so on and so forth. And you're out of that extracting small energy scales. But nevertheless, the signatures are pretty clear. I showed you the D wave variation. Those are measured from tiny shifts.
You're saying it's not clear that this is any evidence pointing towards a nodal liquid in the pseudo gap phase?
Oh, no, it's indicative, but yeah, I don't think it's clear evidence, because it's all at finite temperature, and they don't
doping,
get to
would
really...
Be and all the dopings are such that they eventually become superconductive.
Yeah. So I think the clearest evidence of some kind of nodal metal like that I've seen is there is two. There is a set of data on thermal conductivity, you probably know, by Typer and these guys that go to extremely underdoped samples. And the other is this paper, science paper by Tony Valla and Seamus Davis for LBCO at 1/8 doping.
Right.
So they go to very low temperature, and there is no superconductivity.
Right.
Well, actually, I think those, you know, what you are looking for when you say a new phase, you don't want another order parameter kicking in, some charge ordering and so on and so forth.
Right.
Yes, exactly. And
and still low energy excitation,
sure.
Low energy charge excitation, it's
sure.
Very exotic.
Sure. Yeah. Okay, I mean, that's sort of all I really had to say. And my hope is that, you know, we can discuss more of the connections with gold atoms over this workshop. Okay, thanks.
Questions?
Yeah.
There are some methods to numerically solve the Hamiltonian, like simple Monte Carlo or the MLG, even for 2D systems. And have you compared the energy that you obtain with this variational approach with the energy that have been obtained from the same model with different methods?
Actually, I wasn't aware that for 2D you had other methods. I know in 1D, yes, you have the MRG, and what we have compared with is, you know, basically. But let me make. I think this statement is correct. For 2D, you don't have DMRG doesn't really work because of the number of states that grow. We have compared with exact diagonalization on very tiny systems, and that agrees pretty well. But, you know, really, the story is about long-range correlations, so.
That's a question. Are there any understandings why that the strong projection does not eliminate the order parameter? I mean, a priori, how do I know? Suppose before you do the calculation, I mean, I know it suppresses it. Is there any understanding of why I didn't? Suppose I give you a particular doping. I take the BCS wave function, I have a log diagonal long-range order, and now I project.
You're saying, why does projection not kill the order parameter?
One understanding bosons is that the on-site, I mean...
Well, the system actually gains energy. You know, once you have, it's sort of like, why do bosons form superfluids and not remain normal? If tunneling is possible, then by virtue of the exchange, you can lower the energy.
I think this is a question about wave functions, actually. Yeah. And I mean, I think you're at, you should ask the question the other way around. You know, why would it kill superconductivity? You wrote a wave function that breaks, you know, before you project a fixed particle number, which is just a partial projection.
Oh, you mean,
it breaks the U1 symmetry. How are you going to restore that symmetry? It can't do it unless something really drastic is happening to the Hilbert space.
Yeah,
and that only happens at half filling.
You asked this question, could you have a state without the order parameter? Now it's the same question. So let me tell you about, and not, you know, this is a whole different thing we worked on, but I'll just tell you the result of that. We looked at a model which has, some more diagonal hopping, okay? So which introduced some kind of frustration. And what we find is even though this wave function has all the possibility for making off-diagonal long-range order, there are some cancellations of the way holes move along certain paths which exactly cancels this ODLRO. And you get no phi at finite doping.
Oh, but your unprojected wave function.
No, still, projected.
But your unprojected wave function has U1 proton neutron symmetry.
Yeah. So the unprojected wave function.
To me, that's very exotic.
Yeah. So this is very exotic. I'm sitting on this right now because we are trying to get more understanding. But this is what we find. So my bottom line statement is that sitting in this wave function after projection is kind of pretty novel physics. It's not as easy as we discovered in this case where you had ODLRO before projection, after projection for a range of doping. Not just one doping, for a range of doping, ODLRO vanishes because of this interference of the holes along certain paths.
So in this, that's you mean in this Shastri Sadhana?
Yeah.
So it's just pure this state. There is no Jastrow factors.
No, it's just pure this state.
Now it's a little bit mysterious.
Right, okay. So we can talk about that over lunch.
Another question is that away from half filling, your projected BCS is mostly connected to the species, non projected BCS state. So one can imagine softening the constant.
Ah, okay. Yeah, it is.
Is there a phase temperature?
No.
So qualitatively, always from half.
Yeah, it is qualitatively very much like the BCS-BEC crossover. You know, there is no phase transition, but just as in the BCS limit, I showed. Basically, in the BCS limit, the two energy scales would come together, and they would. So if I did it as a function of U, let's say, I wasn't varying doping. I was at varying U. At very weak U, you would get sort of the two scales coming together, more BCS-like, and then fanning out at larger U. So it is smoothly connected.
More questions?